This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Is the ring in your locker?
No.
Did you take the ring?
No.
Did you steal the ring?
No.
Was the ring stolen?
No.
Did you hide the ring?
All right, so the guy saying no, 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 no is famed actor Alan Alda. And the fellow gently interrogating him about what Alan Alda might have done with a certain ring is Massachusetts forensics expert Steve Lakin.
Did you remove a watch from the drawer?
No.
Did you steal a watch from the drawer?
You gotta get a rubber hose, you know. Make this go much faster.
This right here is the keypad.
Now it's time for the brain scan. The keypad will allow me to answer yes or no as the questions are projected onto a screen above my face.
Alda's experience inside an fMRI machine is part of a recent PBS special documentary called Brains on Trial. It explores the increasing push to introduce neuroscience into the courtrooms. As our understanding of the brain evolves and technology, such as fMRI analysis advances, should brain scans be admissible in court? Could they be used to tell who is lying and who is telling the truth?
Should they be allowed as evidence of suffering? Might they be used to free the innocent and convict the guilty? And as Alda asks in his documentary, if a brain scan can catch an actor in an experiment lying about a stolen ring, what does that mean for such evidence in a real court of law?
Of course, Steve Lakin had a 50-50 chance of catching my lie, even if his method doesn't really work, though he claims an accuracy of some 90% in experiments with volunteer subjects like me. The key question is how my little fib about the ring compares to real-world lies.
So we're going to dive into that question and the broader implications it has on the future of criminal justice. It's a very active area right now. And we'll do so with Nancy Kanwisher. She's a professor at the McGovern Institute for Brain Research at MIT. She was also featured in the new PBS documentary Brains on Trial. She's here with us in the studio. Professor Kanwisher, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Hello.
Listeners, we want to hear from you on this. Do you think that neuroscience, brain scans, fMRI, all of it should be allowed into courtrooms? Do you see a potential for them? Do you see pitfalls? Should our understanding of the inner workings of the mind, whatever understanding we may have right now, be admissible in a court of law? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. So, Professor Kanwisher, there's much to discuss here about the legal implications, but since we've got you, our neuroscientific expert here, I'm wondering if we can just start with you walking us through some of the basics of what the technology does right now. I mean, because I read that fMRI and other brain scanning techniques can potentially be used to explore lie detection, facial recognition, memory decoding, racial bias, brain maturity, intention, even emotions, maybe if not now, sometime down the line. That seems pretty incredible to me. So let's start with the one that's getting all the attention, the fMRI machine. What exactly does it measure when a person's brain is scanned in it?
Okay, so the basic idea is actually pretty simple, and that is that brains are like muscles. If a bunch of neurons fire, that's metabolically expensive. You need to send blood to that part of the brain to supply those neurons. Just like if you go running, you need to send blood to those muscles to supply them so that they can work. And it turns out that when blood is sent to the brain to supply those neurons, luckily it's sent very locally just to the part that's active. It isn't sent to the whole brain. And that's wonderful because it means that we can use local blood flow as a signal for neural activity.
Okay.
It's an indirect proxy, but it's a pretty good proxy.
So pardon me for using a potentially very rudimentary example, but if I'm hungry and I'm thinking, oh, I feel hungry, there's a particular pattern of brain activity that would indicate Magnus thinking she's hungry.
Yes. Whether you could specifically tell that you're hungry as opposed to some other kind of discomfort is a good question. I don't know the answer. You probably could.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I ask because, you know, I wonder, it's one thing to be able to detect that a certain part of the brain is unusually active, but it's another thing entirely to know what that activity means.
Exactly. So for parts of the brain that are very well understood and from which there's a lot of functional MRI data that's already been collected, we can tell a lot just by looking at a pattern of activity, right? So I could tell if you were looking at stimuli or hearing them or moving your fingers very, very easily because you would activate visual cortex or auditory cortex or motor cortex. So mm-hmm. that would be really easy. On the other hand, it's not that exciting to just know if you're looking at something or hearing something. So all of the action and all of the interesting questions reside in how specific and how abstract and how high level is the information that you could read out from MRI data.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of debate about this. There's certainly some very interesting things you can read out. And I'd say the general principle is where you have specific brain patterns for particular mental processes, those are things that you can read out pretty well because you have a diagnostic signal in the brain.
Okay.
So, for example, 15 years ago, my lab did a study where we asked whether the brain has special purpose machinery for face recognition. And we found that, in fact, in every subject, there's a small region, about a half a cubic centimeter, that responds much more when you look at faces than when you look at anything else. And so that region is very, very specific. And that means that activity in that region is highly diagnostic.
But it's active around like the general recognition of a face, but not a specific face?
Well, that's a great question, actually. And so that's actually what I'm more interested in, is the use of these methods to try to understand the components of cognition and how the brain works. So certainly that region responds whenever you look at any old face, even a very basic schematic face. And we also have evidence that it has information about individual faces. But whether we use that region both to detect the presence of a face and to recognize individuals is a very active, ongoing, current area of research.
Okay. And, you know, and very active by at least one measure. I'm looking that when it comes to papers on neuroscience in general, there are thousands coming out per year or in the past couple years at least.
Yeah, it's impossible to keep up with the literature. Mm. I wish everybody would stop so we could just think for a while and stop reading.
It's getting a lot of attention, I mean, in the world of criminal justice as well. But, you know, before we leave the fMRI entirely, I did want to ask you, you know, we played a couple of those clips from the Brains on Trial documentary on PBS that just recently aired. And the example that Alan Alda used was, you know, did he or didn't he lie about stealing a ring or where he might have put a ring? And in that case, as they showed in the documentary, the fMRI data allowed one of the analysts to actually say, yes, I have determined that you've lied, and it turned out to be true. But so, do you think that form of analysis should be admissible in a court of law? What are the problems with it?
Absolutely should not be. And here's why. So the simple pattern that's described in that experiment is actually robust and replicable, and lots of people have found it. That pattern is that when you say something false, that's discriminable in the brain from saying something true. Right. So the reason is that it takes a little bit more mental effort to say something false than something true, even if, as in that case, it's an instructed falsehood. He was told to say that he didn't take the ring. I wouldn't call that a lie. It's an instructed falsehood. Even so, it takes a little more mental effort than just saying what's true. And it's that increase in mental effort that gives you a brain signature for what they're calling lying, but which I would say is actually just mental effort. And so the implication of that is that, in fact, the signal that they're looking at isn't diagnostic at all. Any mental effort will produce that.
Okay. Well, Steve Lakin, told one of our producers as we were doing research for this conversation that 97% of people that have been studied, or at least that he references have been studied, that brains show activity does increase in two specific areas when they were lying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
is that not compelling?
No. In fact, that's true for just the reasons I just said. When people, first of all, it's not lying. It's instructed falsehoods.
Okay.
So when people say something false because you tell them to say something false, there is reliably higher brain signal in these particular regions than when you say something true. But the very same regions will be active when you do mental arithmetic, when you hold information in working memory, when you do any mental effort whatsoever. And so we have a paper coming out in a couple of weeks, actually, where we showed that these regions are extremely general. Any mental effort will turn them on. So that means that they're not diagnostic of anything, lies or anything else. They're just diagnostic of a small increase of mental effort. And so that means you can't use them as an indicator of lying.
Mm-hmm.
And it also means that actually imagine really the case you're comparing it to. The relevant comparison is an innocent person accused of a horrible crime. They're being scanned. They're scared to death because you're scanning their brain, and what if the machine doesn't work? What if the machine kind of thinks they're guilty? They're being asked whether they committed a crime, and they are denying having done it, truthfully. They're probably very, very anxious. And so you'd expect all those same brain regions to be active. That experiment has never been done.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine if you did that experiment, it would have the same signature that Steve Lakin is calling the signature of a lie. And that means it doesn't work to distinguish lies from right. innocent denials.
Because every experiment so far has been done with willing participants in controlled
Absolutely.
Laboratory circumstances.
Absolutely. It's very hard to think about how you would do the proper experiment. I mean, I think it's very important that these things be validated in real-world situations if they were ever going to be used. And nobody's ever tried that. Right? You'd have to have somebody being scanned while they're real stakes, you know, major stakes, like not $50, but say life in prison, right? They'd have to believe while being scanned that the brain scanner could tell if they were telling the truth. And there would have to be a gold standard of truth after the experiment to determine whether, in fact, they were lying or not.
Right.
So those situations would be hard to produce.
Listeners, I'm speaking with Professor Nancy Kanwisher. She's professor of cognitive neuroscience at the McGovern Institute for Brain Research at MIT. And we're talking about the increasing interest that the criminal justice system is showing regarding bringing neuroscience into the courtroom. So the question is, should brain scans be admissible as evidence of any kind in a courtroom, and what implications that would have for our criminal justice system as we know it? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I want to take a quick call here, Professor Kanwisher, from John, who's calling from Melrose. You're on the air, John.
Hey, thanks. Great conversation. I think I haven't seen the elder. I've seen the promo for the program, but I'm interested in his work, and I'm just interested in neuroscience in general. Now, I think all criminals, if people are before the courts act as if they did, you know, as they did hundreds for the last hundreds of years, especially people on death row. I think they should be all scanned, because there is evidence now from a neuroscience point of view of people who have abusive and neglectful childhoods. They develop different brains.
Hmm. John, thank you so much for your call. Professor Kanwisher?
Well, I respectfully disagree, strongly, actually. I don't think they should be scanned for a whole bunch of reasons. As I was just arguing, right now, functional MRI data, and in fact, any kind of MRI data, functional MRI is just one way to use an MRI scanner. You can also use it to look at anatomy, not just function. None of those methods are currently reliably diagnostic of any of these things that would be relevant in a court case. And certainly none of those have been validated in anything like real-world conditions. And so I think it'd be extremely irresponsible to use those data in any legal context.
Right. So just to reiterate, I mean, so far as we know, there haven't been any instances where in an actual trial, a criminal trial, brain scans such as fMRI have been...
Well, that's not quite true. Actually, they've been introduced in court on three occasions.
On three occasions.
On all three occasions, the judges threw the data out on the grounds that there was not sufficient science.
So it never reached a jury.
That's right.
It never reached a jury.
Yep.
So it was attempted to be admitted,
yep.
but they were never admitted.
Yep.
We did find one case in which during the sentencing phase of the trial, so the defendant had been already found guilty of murder, including the murder of a 10-year-old, that his attorneys, and this is in New Mexico, had attempted to use fMRI scans to convince the jury that the defendant should receive a life sentence versus the death penalty. And even in that case, the judge did not allow the actual scans to be shown to a jury, but rather sort of cartoons of the brain. And the neuroscientist who did the examination was allowed to sort of point to parts of the brain. Turns out that wasn't even enough to convince the jury. The defendant ended up getting the death penalty. But so we've been talking about sort of criminal aspects, criminal trials in which brain scans or neuroscience could be used. But of course, that's only one part of the justice system as a whole. What about in, you know, sort of civil cases, for example, when pain and suffering are being taken into account? Is there any place for neuroscience there?
Right. Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, there is some very interesting research using functional MRI to look at pain. And just as a sidebar, to tell you the kind of things that have been done, because it's fabulous science, you can do the following. You can put a person in the scanner and you can shock them to produce mild pain. And you can see reliable activation signatures of pain. You can then ask interesting questions like, let's suppose you're in the scanner and you are watching outside the scanner your romantic partner being shocked. Do you activate the same regions? So the claim has been made and shown in a number of papers that you activate similar regions. And so the idea is that this shows the kind of neural signature of empathy, that you, in some very real sense, feel the other person's pain. Okay, so that's very interesting. And so that kind of result has led people to wonder, might you be able to use functional MRI as some kind of signature of suffering? And Actually, I think it'd be really hard in any legally relevant case, because what you would want is usually the kind of suffering that's relevant is not acute suffering, not how much pain do I feel for these 10 seconds as opposed to those 10 seconds. That's the kind of thing functional MRI is good at. We would be talking about somebody who's suffering in general for months compared to somebody else who's suffering in general less for months. And I don't know of any neural or indeed any signature, biological signature, that would give you ground truth on that. Mm.
And then there's also the issue of what the scans or the science can measure versus the subjective experience of that pain.
Right. Well, if you had a way to validate the MRI signature against some, you know, ground truth, some external ground truth, then you could first validate those signatures in some kind of test and then subsequently use it on other people as a measure. But those kinds of validations are extremely rare and extremely hard to do.
Hmm. Well, so, I mean, given all this, I mean, what are the other ways? I'm exploring, we're exploring in real time here because this is so fascinating to me. And we're doing this, you know, knowing that this isn't fully part of the justice system by any measure yet, but there's so much interest in it. You know, we were talking about fMRI what we can and can't measure. I mean, so the other thing that occurred to me is that, for example, all these measurements, you know, as you just recently noted, are being made well after the fact. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not giving someone a brain scan as they're committing a crime or, you know, as they're experiencing pain that ends up in a civil court. Not at that moment, at least. So that's one issue. You're doing it after the fact. The other issue is, from what I understand, it doesn't take much to basically, I don't want to say fool the computer, but to introduce a lot of noise into the data.
Right. I mean, functional MRI signals are very noisy and very delicate. When we use functional MRI in basic research, which is mostly what I do, I should say that it's a magnificent tool. I mean, it's a fabulous research tool. We've discovered wonderful, thrilling things about the organization of the human mind and brain. And there's no problem there. The problem is the use of functional MRI in the court, right? And so when we do an experiment in the lab, we have to get everything aligned just right in order to be able to interpret the data at all. And even so, we end up throwing out subjects regularly for all kinds of reasons. You know, the scanner just wasn't up to snuff that day for reasons we never diagnose. Or more likely, the subject's head moved too much. Even a few millimeters of head motion is enough to blur the images, rendering them useless. Mm. And so there's 100 ways for scans to go wrong, and it's a precious, lucky, rare thing when everything goes right. And so MRI measures are extremely susceptible to countermeasures.
So thus far, you've been our voice of scientific skepticism, of informed skepticism in terms of the current sort of state of the technology and using neuroscience in the courtroom. And yet, do you ever see a place for it in the criminal justice system or the justice system as a whole?
I think it's really hard to imagine a situation where it could be used responsibly. Certainly for lie detection, I think the problem is, you know, now there's nothing close to relevant evidence. And as I suggested before, if it were to be used responsibly, you would first have to validate it very solidly so that there was a scientific consensus that it worked under real-world conditions. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago, running that experiment would be almost impossible, right? Mm. You would have to have a real crime, a real suspect, real stakes. You'd have to scan them with a person believing that the scan would be used on their trial and that would be able to tell whether they were lying or not. And then you'd have to discover ground truth, whether they were guilty or not. If somebody ever managed to line up all of those conditions and test a large number of subjects to measure how often it was valid, and also to compare, and crucially, the cases of innocent people falsely accused, because you need to be able to show that you can distinguish those two. That's the crux of the matter. If all of that could be done, well, then maybe. But that's nearly impossible.
Nearly impossible. Well, it seems so today.
Well, I mean, the point is it's not a technological limit we're up against in that case. It's arranging the situation where you would find that whole configuration of people accused of trials where you could use the MRI machine in such a way that it was realistic in the way it would have to be to properly test the method.
Mm. But you see why I'm asking, because there is a great desire for the clarity that science can bring to what is inherently an unclear situation, a courtroom. I mean, that's why DNA right now stands as, at least one of the places when done correctly is held as incontrovertible evidence, you know, much more reliable than eyewitness. We don't even allow polygraph exams in courtrooms at all anymore. So science provides a level of certainty that it's really hard to achieve in the justice system as a whole. And like, shouldn't we be encouraging more good science into the courtroom?
Well, if there is good science, yes. And I would say in the case of DNA testing, absolutely. Look at all the people who have been exonerated of crimes that they were previously, convicted of, right? So that's precious and important. But that's because a DNA test is a real test. Like, that's really definitive. That's probative. Right now, there is no MRI test that comes anywhere near the standard of a DNA test, not even close. And when the so it's science as usable in basic research, but it's not science in the sense it can answer a question of relevance in a court case now or actually in the in the next many years, I think.
Right. Well, so is there research going on that is taking a look at, for example, when you pair the neuroscience with behavioral science, anything that helps us understand, how the brain is different when an action is deliberate versus impulsive or conscious versus, done in a panic? Because motive
yes.
is one of the questions in a
yes,
courtroom.
Indeed. That would be very interesting. And there may well be neural signatures of intentional action versus unintentional action. And there are various kinds of areas of the field of neuroscience that look at phenomena like that. But again, as you mentioned a while ago, that's when the action is done in the scanner at best. You could never, never hope to catch a crime being committed inside a scanner. So you wouldn't be able to tell that. And so might you be able to tell after the fact? I just can't even see how you'd do that. The closest thing I can imagine is having somebody reimagine the experience to try to re-evoke the mental processes that happened at the time. But then, of course, that is up to the cooperation of the subject, right? And so if they're trying to conceal their motives, there's absolutely no reason they'd have to cooperate.
Well, I wonder what you think about this, because we have this quotation or excerpt from a magazine called Pacific Standard, in which the author was writing about the intersection of neuroscience and the law. And the writer writes, quote, "Neuroscience is the runaway train of change. Armed with high-tech investigative tools like fMRI, diffusion sensor studies, and positron emission tomography, or PET scans, neuroscientists over the past 30 years have made increasingly provocative and, to many, unsettlingly broad assertions about who we are and how our brains operate." I wonder what your response is to that.
Well, I think that's true. I think we've discovered magnificent things about who we are with functional MRI. I just don't think they belong in court. I'll give you some examples of the kinds of things we've learned. So one of the longest, oldest questions in neuroscience is the question of whether we humans are generally smart, that is, prepared to tackle any cognitive problem that comes our way, or whether we are smart in very particular ways with specialized machinery designed to solve very particular cognitive problems. And so that question has been debated, very acrimoniously for 200 years in our field. With functional MRI, we have a pretty good answer to that question. My lab alone, and loads of other labs as well, but just the work in my lab has discovered a number of brain regions that have spectacularly specific functions. For example, face recognition, place recognition. One of my former students, Rebecca Sachs, discovered a part of the brain that is very selectively involved in thinking about what another person is thinking.
Huh.
That's a spectacular result. And so there's a number of these regions that have very, very specific functions. And I'd say that's a big chunk of who we are as human beings.
Well, Nancy Kanwisher is a professor of cognitive neuroscience at the McGovern Institute for Brain Research at MIT. Professor Kanwisher, thank you so much. Fascinating conversation.
My pleasure.
Well, listeners, let us know what you think about neuroscience and the law. Given all we've talked about today, do you think there should eventually be a place for more brain science in a courtroom? Let us know at radioboston.org. But stick with us, because coming up, the chair of the songwriting department at the Berklee College of Music shares the music of Kay Flay with us in this week's Artery segment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.